healthy life expectancy, social support, freedom, trust, and generosity. But at least the residents of Boulder, Colorado aren't feeling blue, and the mayor will explain why. Her city earned top ranking on the National Geographic Happiest Cities list, which examines civic engagement, walkability, and healthful food options. Support for this live broadcast comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com.
The world is happiness. I'm Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large of The Atlantic. I see so many friends in the audience. I see so many friends from yesterday. I didn't scare them off when we were talking about global pandemics and the end of the world. I think that's why they're at the session today on happiness. And so let me ask, I have one of my colleagues in the back, Chris Collimer, he knows this. I'm usually, you know, the frustrated guy in our shop. I'm the skeptical Nixonian realist who thrives in darkness and cynicism. And I don't know how I got selected for this conversation. So who is genuinely unhappy this morning or skeptical of this whole happiness shtick? Just please announce yourself. Now I will give you the first question when we get there. It's great to be with all of you, but we actually are going to break down happiness. This is going to be a more serious discussion, I think, in trying to make it real. And let me tell you who we have here. Just to my left, we have Dan Buettner. He's the founder of Blue Zones. He's an explorer. He's a National Geographic Fellow, an award-winning journalist, producer, writer, New York Times best-selling author. You've got to get his book if you're into this subject, called The Blue Zones, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who Live the Longest. He's got all sorts of other cool-sounding books, too. So hit Amazon, go to that one-click thing, and there's your plug. So do a good job.
Don't go to your local bookstore.
And we have, as well, Suzanne... goes by Zan, Suzanne Jones, mayor of Boulder, Colorado. Super cool. I think I met her 20 years ago, and I hardly remember anyone I met. She doesn't remember meeting me. But I do think in West Cliff, Colorado, she was blowing me away with all of her kind of like healthy lifestyle stuff, biking, running, skiing, all the kind of things that Boulder people do. But now you're mayor, and Boulder, if you didn't know, has been designated as the happiest city in America.
Much to our surprise.
Much to our surprise. You know, we were just talking over here on this side, and she says, I'm still shocked that we were picked. And Dan said, you weren't picked, you earned it. So let me just start out with Dan for a minute, and you know, let's have a conversation, and just say, can you start by identifying the happiest people in this room?
I can't. Well, let me first say...
None of them say they're unhappy, by the way.
We'll find them.
Yeah.
I just want to start by saying I'm shocked and delighted to see so many people out this early on a Saturday morning. Given Aspen's high-rolling reputation for fun, I figured people would just be rolling in from the club about now. But So with two questions, either-or questions, I can identify the happiest people in this room. And your job is to raise your hand when the answer occurs to you. So the two questions are, first question's about whether you think life is long or short, either-or. So raise your hand if you think life is short. Now raise your hand if you think life is long. All right, the minority, interesting, remember that. Now raise your hand if you think, this second question is whether you think life is hard or easy. So raise your hand if you think life is hard. Now raise your hand if you think life is easy. Interesting. So I want everybody who raised their hand who think that life is long and easy to stand up. If you thought life is long and easy, stand up. And stay standing. So a few years ago, a Harvard research, don't worry, I won't humiliate you too much. A Harvard researcher named Mike Norton asked these same questions and correlated it to happiness, life satisfaction, generosity, and civics. And he did this on three continents, 2,500 surveys. And he found that people who think that life is short and hard are the least happy people. People think that life is long and hard, and people think that life is short and easier in the middle, but the happiest people are people who think that life is long and easy. So can we give a round of applause for the people standing here? They're the happiest people in the room. They're not only the people you want to invite to your next cocktail party,
I just want to say that I was raised believing that happiness is a function of relative deprivation. So all of you really happy people, I really resent you. So thank you for taking us down there, Dan. What I liked about it is you mentioned Harvard research, and I know you're a believer in research and sort of the science of happiness, and you've been engaged. You interviewed the mayor a long time ago, basically about various factors like walkability, you know, financial circumstances, the proximity of good food. You know, there are various dimensions. So I'm just interested, you know, give us a start about the science of happiness and measuring happiness, and how you would. You've told us what the best city is. Tell us what the crappiest city is in terms of happiness.
Well, the least, in general, the least happy cities in America are in the Rust Belt, in southeastern
like Cleveland
part of the United,
or
West Virginia,
West Virginia,
Huntington, southern Texas. They tend to be places where people voted for Trump, quite honestly.
We're going to get to that later.
Yeah.
Where life
remember,
is
this
hard.
Is a balanced room. 50% are one side of that thing. You know, I'll just maintain. Yeah, go ahead.
And
so science.
Way,
back to the science.
Well, yeah. So it's not like some scientist came and bestowed the title of unhappiness. It's really a reflection of what people themselves say about their own lives.
Right.
So that's mostly what I dealt in for this story.
So can you walk us there? I know you've got a visual talking about how you measure happiness. So.
If you could put
that
first slide.
Do we have that up there? Do we have a
yeah.
screen?
So for this story and for the book, I relied on two huge pools of data. The first one was a collaboration from Google, Gallup, and University of Pennsylvania World Wellbeing Project. And they correlated happiness in about 220 cities, with 5 billion Google searches. And
wow.
They found that we can actually predict your happiness better with what you look for on Google, what you search for on Google, than your education level or your income level. So it's a very good predictor. Not only that, incidentally, we found that people who own dogs and are Googling about their dogs are happier than cat owners. go figure. We found that people who are looking for movies about action and comedies are happier than people who are looking for romance movies. And for those of you who prefer your romance by yourself in a room, we found that people who are looking for softcore porn are happier than those who like the harder stuff. So
you had to go there.
By the way, it's anonymous data, so we don't know who you are. But for most of this work, we rely on a much deeper, credible pool. The World Value Survey and the World Database of Happiness out of Europe, they have gathered data from 95% of the human population, representing 95% of the human population, in more than 155 countries. And with that, they've garnered big data insight. So first of all, you have to realize that happiness itself, academically speaking, is a meaningless term because you can't really measure happiness. But psychologists...
This is making me feel better now.
You're going to be happy by the time we're done here. But they can measure life satisfaction. And the way they do that is they ask people, when you think of your life as a whole on a scale of 1 to 10, how satisfied are you with your life? And that's a pretty good measurement, actually. It's an evaluative measurement of your happiness. But you only remember about 2% of your life. You tend to remember the high points and the low points and what happened last. So if I asked you what you had for lunch a week ago Tuesday, you probably couldn't tell me. But you can remember the last 24 hours pretty well. So psychologists get at your how you experience your life by asking you to remember the last 24 hours and how much joy, how much you smiled, how much stress you had. And from that, we can garner your daily emotions. And then the third measurement is purpose. How often do you get to use your strengths to do what you do best every day? And when you ask those three questions in a survey with 75 other questions about your demographics, your life characteristics, your values, and using the statistical trick of regression analysis and data that represents 95% of the human population, We can find out very clearly what sorts of things accompany happiness. And two of the most interesting things are, number one, you may have heard that age is on a U-shaped curve. We tend to be pretty happy when we're in our 20s and optimistic and dating and so forth. When we get down between 45 and 55, about 50 is the toughest year when it comes to happiness for Americans. It varies in different countries, but 50 is the toughest years. And then happiness continues to rise. And as long as you keep your health, happiness rises into your hundreds. In fact, the happiest cohort in America are healthy people over age 100. There's not many of them, but it's worth shooting for.
They're happy to be alive.
The second thing in this Me Too generation, by the way, in countries where there is not gender equality, the women are happier than the men. And in countries where there is gender equality, the men are happier than the women. So note to self, men.
Fascinating journey. So let's jump to Boulder. And Boulder, I know, ranks, I mean, I was surprised to see that Boulder per capita has more people that walk to work than any other city in America. And that you've got bikers, people apparently very high level of engagement. But one of the things I noticed is that stress is on the rise in Boulder. So how does what Dan just shared with us in terms of characteristics, and you as a responsible mayor in a city trying to push those needles of happiness, how have you been able to kind of change the ship? Or did you just inherit a city that was happy already? Was it ever miserable and you're like, felt okay, we have to fix this?
Well, first off, let's be clear, the mayor is not in charge. We are the People's Republic of Boulder. I mean, we were dealt a good hand. Like this city, we are in a beautiful place with a high quality of life. And I think that, let's not underestimate, that's a big step up. We have invested a lot in preserving that and enhancing that. And I think that that's an important part of what we've done. And the character that you used to illustrate Boulder in the National Geographic was a citizen activist who helped us pass our open space ordinance. We were the first city to tax ourselves to protect open space. Mm. And we have bought up we basically live in a green donut, 45,000 acres of open space. Now, this is where we recreate, where we see our wildlife, where we connect to nature. And that panels on how important that is, and I think in Boulder people are very clear. We are lucky to live there, we are blessed, and we'll take care of this place. So there's that. But I think the thing that Dan and I talked when he came to interview me, whatever that was, a year and a half ago, we talked all about purpose. And I do think that that's where Boulder, that speaks to Boulder more, is this idea that because we can, we should be wrestling with the big issues of the day and leading where we can. We have a university, we have a dozen federal labs, we have more climate scientists per capita than just about anywhere. And so there's this sense that we need to be doing something relevant in addition to having this high quality of life.
So is that like a cult? So that, you know, people move there and they're assigned a task, or do you think it attracts people who want to have purpose?
That's an interesting question. I mean, given that almost a third of our city is students and professors, I think that that's also being around ideas and energy and simulation and youth and all of that, I think is part of it. So people get attracted here and then they don't leave, which is another problem. And let's be clear, we have all sorts of challenges just like everywhere else. So that's why people thought it was kind of funny
what
that we are the happiest.
Challenges?
Affordability and housing. Hmm. Just like this place, only, no offense to Aspen, that's the model of whatever you do, let's not get as bad off in terms of the gap between the have and the have-nots and affordability. But we also look to all the things that you've tried and see if we can replicate them. But that's the biggest thing, is people are moving to Colorado in droves. Why wouldn't they? And housing hasn't kept up. But also there's this wrestling match between, hey, we used to be all about slow growth and that was the environmentally correct thing to do. And now we've realized, to get all these people on the planet, density and smaller carbon footprint is the way to go. But still, you want your sense of community, you want your sense of size, the rate of change matters. And so how do you manage that in a way that retains diversity and inclusivity is the big nut that everybody's trying to crack.
Do you have diversity there? I was reading some stats on Boulder. It was 81.5% white. 22% of people live below the poverty line, but 70% of those are college age, meaning they're probably students.
Yep.
Median household income is about $61,000. So you're a pretty wealthy white community. And so I think one of the interesting questions is there, as we are in an age where we're talking a lot about inclusion and diversity and race and inequality and social stress and tension points, are you just in a lucky spot or an unlucky spot? How do you look at that dimension of this? I mean, when I'm in Aspen, and even when I come to the Ideas Festival, I always ask myself about, are we doing all we can to promote an inclusive, like, full crowd here? And so I know that you have what you have in the city, but I also want to come to Dan in a moment, saying, how does that factor into your happiness research? But
yes, we are awfully white and tend to be on the more well-off. And so we have made a real priority around how do we become more inclusive. And a lot of that gets back to affordability. Hmm. If you want diversity, you need to provide for all the socioeconomic strata. So we have one of the more aggressive affordable housing programs in the country. Hmm. We can talk more about that. We just did a survey to find out, okay, do people of color and people that are, you know, of different religions, do they feel welcome here? And if so, why not? Or if not, why not? And what can we do about it? We made ourselves a sanctuary city. We have a growing Hispanic population. So we're doing a lot of different things to try to embrace and retain in the face of this incredible market wave that's making, you know, the median house, single family house now is $1 million. I couldn't afford to live there, except for I happened to get here 20 years ago. So yes, it's
fascinating,
a problem.
But you're aware of it, and you're working on it. Like, you're self-critical,
yes,
in a sense,
yes,
as a city.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Dan, how does that figure into the science of happiness in cities?
Well, the first thing to realize is it's rich and white, not because a bunch of rich white people had all of a sudden moved there. Like you find in every happy place in the world, the happiest place, it is never a coincidence. There's always a genesis. And it's usually enlightened leaders 50 to 100 years ago or so, shifted from just economic development to passing policies that favor quality of life. In other words, business interests don't just take over and it's just all development. There's really a team of people like the city council in Boulder who really focus on building quality of life. And some of the things that we know most highly correlate with life satisfaction from this thing here are access to green spaces, access to places where you can recreate and do sports, health and happiness. You cannot really pull them apart. So if you live in a place where it's all concrete and it's very hard to get your exercise, people are going to be less healthy and therefore less happy. Other things we know correlate: access to healthy food. Boulder does a great job making sure healthy fruits and vegetables are very accessible. Billboards. Boulder has no billboards. Raise your hand if you like billboards. The only people
like the movie about.
The only people like billboards are the advertisers and people selling things. So billboards, they tend to be full of things that encourage us to buy things we don't need and eat food we shouldn't be eating. And it's actually a great sort of city policy to not have billboards. And one of the best bellwethers of whether or not you're in a happy city is the bikeability. Happiest city
it's
in the world.
It's one of the top things, right?
Yeah, is in Copenhagen. Yeah. So Boulder is not just a coincidence that there's more bike traffic there than there's car traffic. It's the city planners sat down and said, how do we invite cyclists? How do we invite walkers? And they've done things like when you come to a street light, it'll sensors the walker there. It'll turn green for the walker. And traffic slows down, and it's safe, and there's trees. This is not a coincidence, but it all produces a manifestly happier place. And then in 1970, Boulder was full of basically poor hippies, you know, the Celestial Seasons, and People like Ruth Wright, who I profiled for the Geographic piece, she recognized that the view they have of the what are those mountains?
Flat irons
is precious, and developers wanted to come in and build 14-story high rises, and there's a plan to have up to 40 of those. So all of a sudden, this place where you can sit in any office building and see this gorgeous landscape was going to become a skyscape. And the people working with the city council, and they had to listen to all voices. It wasn't just a bunch of left-wingers pile-driving what they wanted. There was many years of conversation, but they managed to maintain this beautiful skyline and the walkability. And they worked hard for it. And sort of the point of the article in the book is there is a blueprint to create a healthier city, and Boulder's one of the best examples, and we should be aspiring to the condition of Boulder.
Fascinating. Anybody from Oklahoma City? Anyone? Where? Yeah, so I happen to have become recently a fan of Oklahoma. I mean, my family is originally from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, which is about 3 hours north, but not a happy city. But Oklahoma City is interesting, and I want to mention it because I think sometimes it's useful to think about places that aren't as happy and what they've done. And so one of the interesting things is the mayor of Oklahoma City, of whom I become a kind of fan, realized that they were not only appearing on the front of business and economic magazines as one of the fastest growing economies in the country, a lot of good things were going on there, but they were also appearing in health magazines as one of the most obese cities in America, including himself. And so he started a campaign to basically try and get people online, create a network, and create community, and got 40,000 people in Oklahoma City region to lose collectively 1 million pounds. So it's really an amazing story. And so when you kind of look at that, and then what did that lead to? It led to more engagement across race, across socioeconomic class. People began talking, and they began in city planning beginning to look at ways in which they could increase walkability in the city. So I just want to ask you a question about that, rather than talking about the top end, though we all love Boulder and we'll get this, what about the most improved cities? Is there any sort of scale? Like, I find the model of what Oklahoma City did and is trying, and I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana recently. Baton Rouge is a fascinating place, but it's also struggling with obesity in ways, and I met probably the best people I've ever met in the world, totally fatigued by trying to figure out how to solve some of these problems that had become so chronic. And have you looked into that in any of your National Geographic and Gallup research of what a city that doesn't have these attributes can do today because it didn't have that leader 50 or 100 years ago?
Well, my other hat I wear, I lead projects in 26 cities to do exactly that. The Blue Zones projects. And the first thing to realize is that if you try to change people's behavior, you'll fail. Trying to get people on diets and exercise and to remember positive psychology strategies, they'll work for the short run, usually a few months. But then people forget it or they'll lose discipline. The secret to creating happier places is to optimize the environment. And we now have very clear strategies to change the environment. So we know the happiest people in America are interacting face-to-face 6 hours a day. And this, I don't mean Facebook. I mean face-to-face, the way we evolve. So how do you get that to happen? Well, you design spaces for people to meet. San Luis Obispo is a really good example. That was a kind of a crappy city in the 1980s. The Mission Square was a parking lot, and some enlightened Boulder-esque mayors and city council went in and say, no, we're going to change this into a place where older people can come together, kids can play, and we have outdoor cafes. They did the same thing about favoring one of the predictors of happiness are people's consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables. The measure is if you have it at least 4 times a week. So San Luis Obispo has a market every Thursday night where a farmer's market where they've really invested heavily in there, where there's a street dance. Not only can you buy your fruits and vegetables, but it's a big party. There's bike concierge. So they make this effort to bring people together and get them connected.
What would you say about if you were to all of a sudden move to, I don't know, trying to think of a city that really needs help.
Well, I would think of Denver 20 years ago.
Denver. Well, Denver's cool now.
Well, I know, but Denver's it remade. The reason that I think it's cool is it rediscovered its river that runs through it, and instead of bombed out warehouses, it is now the place you go to recreate, and they build all the housing along the river, and so people are out biking and walking, and it's totally re-enlivened their downtown, and now it's kind of a cool, hip place to go. So anyhow, same sort of thing. I think Denver is a good example.
Is this kind of, is gravity taking us here? I mean, as I think about this, I haven't been to Montgomery, Alabama in a while, but the last time I was there, it didn't feel great. I don't know if anybody's from Montgomery who might have a different view. But when I was in Atlanta the other day and walked through that big park in the middle of town and saw this old Sears Roebuck that had been turned into a kind of a hip, cool marketing center, and you know, saw just every kind of person you could imagine of every color, flavor, background in this park, where there are so many free services, swimming pools for kids, you know, no fees, etc. You know, I look at Atlanta as another one of these cities that's turning the corner. Who are your biggest clients? Because I know people pay you to help become
longer. Well, it's the Blue Cross Blue Shield, but the
insurance company.
The insurance company. So we have Blue Cross Blue Shield usually, or the hospital systems, and we come in with a team of people and work 3 to 5 years, and we help them arrive at consensus around evidence-based policies that are more likely to make them happy and healthy. We certify restaurants, grocery stores, workplaces, and schools for them to change their policy and design, and we get 15% of the population. But we only get paid if we lower BMI or raise happiness. So this Thursday, in fact...
Results-oriented.
Only results-oriented. So Fort Worth is our biggest city. And
what do you find? I mean, this is so interesting. What do you find your clients, cities, firms, insurance companies, your players you're trying to influence, what do you find they most resist doing that you think is key to their success? What do they say, or you know, ultimately you really have to push?
Let me turn that question around a little bit. I find if you come in and try to tell a city what to do, they're gonna show you the door in a hurry. Mm. So we actually kind of opened the kimono, and most of what we're saying is that we're gonna change your environment so the healthy, happy option is the easy, evidence-based. Mm-hmm. And before we go into a city, we get the mayor, the city council, the chamber of commerce, the superintendent of schools, the big CEOs, the police chief, they all have to see exactly what we're gonna do. They have to sign a pledge and they audition. So once the public sector's on board, the best way to waste money and time is have a city that doesn't really want you. So we make sure they want it. Then we have a clear policy pathway. And then once we get their buy-in, and then we go to the nearby insurance company or hospital system or health foundation and say, look, these guys are ready. Here's what we've done in the past. We think we could probably make a big difference. And usually in 3 to 5 years, we can see a significant, and we have Gallup measure it, by the way. Mm. So if you can't measure it, you can't manage it.
It's fascinating.
And then every year we get a report card, and we're expected to see improvement every year.
Mayor, I know you talked a lot about engagement, and that intrigues me. And just I sort of made light of it because I do believe that engagement and social connectivity, connection to purposes, it sounds really inspiring. I know that you're Moonlight as the head of EcoCycle, which you might want to explain to folks what EcoCycle does. I know that you lived in D.C. It's probably the least happy place in America right now.
That's not bad.
But it's probably actually because we've got bikeability in the past, but it's toxic there right now. We just have to admit there are other things going on. But when you are talking about that and kind of looking at this, what insights do you have about a community that finds great purpose in what it's doing that can be replicable in other places? Like, how do you think that spirit of purpose could move to another environment?
Well, I wasn't joking when I said it's the People's Republic. Mm. We do a lot of public process, in part because we have a history of citizen activism and engagement, and where the citizens are leading, through ballot measures and whatnot. And the city council, if it's smart, will follow. And so I do think fostering, we have lots of boards and commissions. Whenever we're doing some big project, we set up working groups. I mean, we have a lot of smart people, like the city, like many of the cities you all live in, a lot of smart people with a lot of talent that would love to sit on a working group to help craft something and recommend to city council, this is how you should do X or what. And so I think cultivating that, expecting that, there's a sense of ownership and responsibility. If you don't like something, well, then do something about it. Mm. And And I think it also has to do with, also extends beyond our borders. I remember after the election, it must have been February, a story is that a couple of women were frustrated, obviously, we're all frustrated. And so they asked this new groovy food truck brewery place, hey, can we borrow a couple of tables to have a postcard writing session? And they put it out on Facebook. 500 people showed up. They boxes of postcards. I mean, these are blank postcards with, you know, address to Trump, to the Congress, to state legislature. And they were blank, and people were writing, here's what I care about, here's what you need to be doing. And it was this, like, we must take charge, not just of Boulder, but, like, we need to help lead. I think processes that foster engagement, where you actually listen to what people say and try to incorporate it, is pretty key. I'll also note that a lot of the things that I think people point to about that Boulder's done wisely were citizen-led initiatives. The open space, the height limit, the protecting the Flatirons from development. We just did a tax on sugary beverages. Mm. There's no way the city council would have done that, but people came and said, we care about the kids, and it was also led by a bunch of Latino folks that were worried about childhood obesity, and they're like, we want to tax it and use that money to do all these kid recreation programs, and the people passed it. And so that's what we're doing. And
brilliant. Let me just one last question, Dan. I want to go to the audience. The other day, The Atlantic did a program on health inequality in cities, and we were in Baltimore. And if you go to Baltimore, this is not a feel-good story. You can look at certain communities. There are 11 communities inside Baltimore that the average lifespan is 20 years less than the wealthiest parts of Baltimore. And it does correlate with both racial differences and economic differences. And so when you look at a place and you're sort of there was this amazing commissioner for health that I had the privilege to interview up there, who's made this her mission to really move that needle and change it. So when we talk about happiness, when we talk about some of this stuff, some places are really struggling. And when you've got a 20-year age disparity in terms of lifespan within the same region, that is something. So what are the best lessons you can share just off the top of your head with somebody struggling with that sort of tension?
Well, okay, for leaders, I think a leader in an area like that, they are vocal about the importance of volunteerism. No matter where you go in the world, people who volunteer are happier than those people who don't. In America, only about 30% of people who are working, this is a quarter Gallup, actually like their job. So if they want to live out their purpose, whether they live in one of these bad neighborhoods or good neighborhoods, most of the time they're going to have to find an outlet for that purpose that's not at their job.
Right.
Generally, I believe that policies that limit fast food restaurants is going to make a difference. Again, making streets that are walkable and bikeable. Planting trees makes a huge difference in these places. There's even research that shows some of these places that are going to have low life neighborhoods that have low life expectancy, doing something as simple as cleaning up graffiti or fixing broken windows, a very cheap and easy way that have shown elsewhere in the world can raise the happiness, and because happiness and longevity are so well connected. I'm just dying to show you this one last slide, which you're going to like. This is about America. This is brand new research, and this comes from University of Pennsylvania, 1.5 million surveys of Americans. And remember I said there's a couple types of happiness. There's how people evaluate their lives, which is on this vertical axis here, and then how people experience their life day to day. So we distilled that down. We find there's different kinds of happiness in America. So where there's both low life satisfaction and low happiness are suburbs in America, and the least happy are evangelical hubs and working class country. We talked about that before. And then going up the or along the happiness schedule, in other words, places where people actually enjoy their lives, but they don't necessarily get a lot done, are, the number one are aging farming communities. So this is in the Midwest where people may, they're actually really loving their life, waking up in the morning, going to the diner, chewing the fat, maybe not getting a hell of a lot done, but they're enjoying their day. And then when it comes to life satisfaction, people really are proud of their lives. Interesting, African-American cities in the South, they're at the communities in the South, they're actually happier than their white counterparts there. And then big cities. Big cities are places where people get a lot of stuff done, but they don't necessarily love their life. But where the sweet spot is here, college towns like Boulder, San Luis Obispo, military posts, but then the outlier that this kind of shocked me, actually Mormon communities are the extreme in both. So again, this comes from a really deep data set taken over 5 years.
Well, does that have to do with the sense of community?
I just think it's not much help.
We don't know. It could be. Yes, they feel connected. They tend to be very happy.
I was in St. George, Utah the other day, and I tried to order a drink, and it was a challenge.
It could be collective delusion. We don't know, but we're just. They seem to not only like their life, but
fascinating. Cool. This is. I grew up on Department of. Grew up on military bases. I was an Air Force brat. I'm sure there are other military brats. Any who was a military brat? Yeah, did you remember this particularly happy place? I didn't. So that's very interesting data. Something's definitely changed. In any case, let's go to all of you. Let's go to your questions, comments, thoughts. And we've got right up here in front. We'll go in the back. We'll go over here. We'll go over here. So we have the mic. It's Noor, right, Nora? Right here in the front, this gentleman in the blue. He set me up at the beginning. He said, I want to ask the first question. So you've got a microphone. There you go. Ron.
Actually, I did not say that.
I know.
It's okay. Question for the mayor. I'm shocked with the desire on the part of the community to be a sanctuary city, which to me is something I'd just be curious about why and how that happened, given the opposite side or the controversy dealing with sanctuary cities and safety.
So we'll...
Sanctuary city. We talked to folks in our community, undocumented DACA students, and they said, will you please stand up for us? And we said, yes, we will. And it was over. It was not controversial in Boulder. I think also there's a sense of outrage about what this administration stands for in terms of our heritage as a country and our relationship with immigration. And so people were wanting to say. And also there's another underlying issue here, which is just that local police. Don't want to be in the business of dealing with ICE, the detention, the federal immigration law, because we want everybody in the community, whether you are there legally or whether you are documented or not documented, to call the police if there's a crime, to call the fire department if there's a fire, and to feel safe. And if people feel like they can't deal with local city employees because they're afraid that they will turn them in, you have a breakdown. So anyhow, that's why.
Is Denver a sanctuary city?
But not in name.
It is in practice, but not in name. It's
correct.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of cities that feel that way because it breaks right. down your local law enforcement.
Thank you for raising it. In the very back.
Thanks. I'm Dylan Edwards. I work for a program of the Aspen Institute called AMP Health. I'm originally from South Africa. South Africa is the most unequal society on Earth by most studies. It's either us or Brazil generally paying the inequality World
right.
Cup final
Brazil?
Every year.
Yeah.
And we are the 105th most happy country in the world, one place above Iran, one place below Palestine.
So you're saying America at number 18, that's not so
bad. Not too bad. But you're facing a rising inequality problem, yeah. and it seems to me that that's probably not a coincidence. Those two things are probably
right.
related. And I just wanted to the entire panel, taking a lens away from looking at cities, looking nationally in the U.S. and to other countries,
right.
And developing countries in particular, are there lessons that we can apply at a national level, at policy level, to get happier?
Right. What insights do you have for that? Thank you.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go to this woman right back here. But go ahead, Dan.
Yeah. So my work was a statistical exercise to try to predict what was more likely to bring happiness. So if you take all this data from 155 countries in America and you correlate it, you find that the biggest predictors of happiness are tolerance. Are you free to live out your values regardless of who you are? Equality, the short ladder between the richest and the poorest. So places like Denmark that have the shortest ladder, not coincidentally, I believe, are the happiest, and places like Brazil, which have the longest, and it's South Africa, they underperform given their GDP is a predictor, but GDP is only a useful predictor of happiness for poor countries. GDP makes a lot of difference if you're Bangladesh, but makes almost no difference if you're Switzerland. Raising the GDP of Switzerland is not going to do anything to raise their happiness. Bangladesh, it's a lot. A healthy life expectancy, the other big. So that you know, if you're a leader that's actually interested in producing happiness, which Thomas Jefferson charged, then you'd want to pass policies that favor equality, right, tolerance, trust, healthy life expectancy. Those levers are going to make the biggest difference if you want to produce a happy nation.
Just my one editorial, because I read a lot of material preparing for today, and I can't recall where I read this, but I'm sure you can search for it. But one of the fascinating stories I read about was the mayor of Bogota, and how essentially he took money that was set aside for major highways and turned them into bike paths, yeah, and did things, shutting cars down, creating a very different relationship with vehicles. So I don't know if that's going to fit the case of what to do in South Africa, but I think part of the lesson of today, what I hope you get, and it's so wonderful to have Suzanne Jones here in telling us about a place that's got so much of it right, but it's often looking at the worst places. So if you're going to rank places, look at the worst places, and also then look at the places that were bad that began to actually make significant changes, like in Oklahoma City, like a Bogota, which are, of course, cities, and not, it doesn't fully address your country question, but that might be a useful resource. Let's go to right, you right here. You were here. And we're going to go short questions, short answers, because I want to get as many of you in as I can. Yes.
Thank you so much. First, I wanted to thank you, Dan. My favorite class in college was called Happiness, and we used your book as our textbook for
Great.
That. It was fantastic. But
it's called Recurring Returns Without Recurring Effort.
It's fantastic.
book.
About gentrification, a lot of the time, the sort of indicators of happiness that we see in these sort of cities, usually to get those, they accompany gentrification in some way.
Right.
How do we prevent that from happening in different communities as we move forward? Thanks.
Okay.
What was the question?
Gentrification.
Gentrification.
Well, it depends what you mean by gentrification. It's, so you're asking if gentrification makes places happier?
Because you improve a neighborhood and you displace people.
The thing is, you know, there's this housing problem with Boulder. I think rather than trying to pour into Boulder, there's a bunch of other cities along the range where you take what Boulder did and you bring a new generation of people who want to, and you follow the Boulder path rather than try to fill a vessel that's already pretty full. That's just my opinion.
Probably. Well, I'll just say it's a huge issue in Denver. And basically, the problem is you make a place nicer, and then people with means move in, and then the poor people that used to be there get moved out.
Right.
And that's where I think government policies around affordability and affordable housing and ensuring mixed neighborhoods and giving people access to that are essential. Otherwise, it's a pattern you see again and again.
Yes, ma'am, right here. Yeah.
Good morning. Question relates to the slide that showed this life satisfaction and the fact that Mormons and military bases are happy. Doesn't that show that we as humans like control? We like that psychologically human beings do better when there's firm rules for them to follow, and that when the rules are kind of fuzzy, people tend to be unhappy?
Yep, I have a really great
fuzzy
answer.
Fuzzy rules or autocracy?
Okay, for the geographic article, I found the three happiest places in the world: Singapore, Denmark, and Costa Rica, and they're all happy in different places. The happiest place in Asia is Singapore. And one of the main reasons they're happy, to your point, is that there's a very clear path to success in life. Get in the right school, get the right job, get in the right club. Financial security is almost secure for sure. Your mother will be proud of you. Your friends will be impressed. And when you look in the rearview mirror, you're very satisfied with your life. That's one kind of happiness. But then there's the other kind of happiness where you see in Costa Rica, where people are enjoying their life day to day and having more social interactions, drinking coffee, and hanging out with their family.
Great question. Right here, Secretary Glickman. We're going to get a microphone here.
It's interesting. You have evangelical hubs on the low end, and you have the LDS on the high end. And I ask a question about faith and spirituality. I've read about people who are, in fact, have deep faith and attend church or synagogue or mosque late in life. They have longer life periods, And I wonder if that factors into your
thinking. Absolutely does. So you can't really measure spirituality, but you can measure religiosity. And that's measured by how often you show up to a faith-based community. So those people are showing up 4 times per month, are living 4 to 14 years longer than people who don't. And that's especially powerful for people who live in the inner city and minorities. When it comes to happiness, it generally people are religious are happier than those aren't, but you're more likely to be happy being religious if you live in a religious place. So if you live in Latin America, being religious, big plus. If in Denmark, it's not so powerful.
Right here in the middle. Right here in the middle. I like this going fast, fast questions, fast answers. So, yes.
My name is Buren. I'm Boulderite. And then first time I seen my mayor in person.
Oh.
Thank you very much. The city
you
council.
You like her?
No, of course. I do everybody in Boulder. And I live there more than 10 years.
Okay.
And Boulder does everything possible to make this paradise, I say. And my son and I'm immigrant myself. And widow and single mom 11 years ago came to Boulder because of the school system. And we survived. And why I mention that, because of the good community, how to support, how to create us, we rise.
Living proof.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
No,
thank
you. And then I have a couple questions.
You got one quick question because we're nearly out of time. So.
What's the ethnicity of the percentage of the ethnicity in our Boulder? And then what's the last number in Boulder population now?
Yeah, population now,
and what's the age
ethnic participation? I mean, you're 82% white, but what's the rest?
Then Hispanic and a little bit of Asian, very little African American.
Total population?
108,000.
Interesting. Let's go right here.
108,000. Yeah, okay, no.
Age span?
Age span.
Age span. Lifespan?
In Boulder.
How long we live?
Yeah.
I do not know that.
Endlessly. So I apologize. We really have to go. But thank you so much for your story. I appreciate it. But right here, I'm trying to get to as many people as we can. I'll get back to you in a second.
So Jared Diamond has written about the impact of geography on culture.
He's more my kind of guy. War, destruction, end of time.
But my question is, when you go into a city and you look at the geography, if it's contained within a valley versus widely dispersed over flatland,
right.
Do you have a different strategy for implementation for a dispersed versus a concentrated?
So there's all kinds of very easy policies that will limit sprawl. So the green belt that you see in Boulder or in Portland or in San Luis Obispo, you can also limit the size of people's plots of land to under a quarter of an acre. You'll also limit sprawl. And then not financing infrastructure, which is a bad investment usually.
And we're going to go here. And I apologize, everyone. We're right at the end of time, and I want you to be able to get to your next session. But yes, who are you? And
hi.
Give it and make it good.
No pressure.
Shit, this wasn't so good. I've read many studies saying that one of the best ways to change habits in adults is to teach children those good habits.
Right.
Get a kid to volunteer, their parent volunteers. Get a kid to learn about obesity, their parent loses weight. So I'm curious about your comment about not changing habits as part of your model and how much that plays in terms of educating kids in the next generation on these healthy habits that increase lifespan and happiness.
That's a wonderful last question. I want to just put in a plug for the Aspen Institute because they have a center, and I actually can't remember, this run by Aaron Mosley, but one of the things they look at in terms of dealing with school-to-prison pipelines, poverty, issues like this, is a second-generation approach, that if you're not dealing with a two-generation approach, you're really not changing anything. So I want to say it's both on the positive side, but also trying to correct other issues. So thanks so much for raising that.
So very quick two-part. I still don't believe you're going to be very successful at changing habits. However, you can give kids skills that will make them more likely they're happy. So in Denmark, for example, very happy place, these folk schools teach kids, rather than just No Child Left Behind, language arts, math, and science, they teach consensus, civics, art appreciations, and those are lifelong skills that will favor happiness.
Mayor?
I'll just say my day job is running EcoCycle, which does recycling and composting and advocacy around that, and we have a huge school program with precisely that goal and outcome, which is you teach the kids how to recycle, and they go home, and they teach their parents, and it works.
Wow, fascinating. I just want to say that, you know, I'm still stuck in that kind of dogs and cats thing. I once wrote a piece, didn't go over well. I once wrote a piece saying, you know, Joe Biden reminded me of Golden Retriever and Obama of a Russian blue cat. And you think about it, it does work and fit, but they were not too happy with that piece. But thank you for a wonderful discussion. Please give a round of applause to Dan Buettner of Blue Zones and Mayor Zan Jones of Boulder.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to Where in the World is Happiness? A live broadcast from the Aspen Institute's Spotlight Health Conference. You can find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. You can also see the entire broadcast schedule throughout the Aspen Ideas Festival on our front page. Support for this live broadcast comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. Support comes from the City of Aspen Transportation and Parking Departments and the Drive Less Initiative. Driving less can save time, money, and natural resources. Learn more at driveless.net. And from the Aspen Institute, presenting the McCloskey Speaker Series, featuring Associate Justice Stephen Breyer of the Supreme Court of the United States, July 7th, from 4 to 5. Tickets at aspenshowtix.com. We return to Weekend Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. Thanks for listening.